Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be bringing you this webinar on FCRA litigation pitfalls to watch out for. Among the major laws regulating the credit collection industry, the Fair Credit Reporting Act is the one where the number of lawsuits is consistently increasing. Companies in the industry are defending themselves against more FCRA lawsuits than ever before. In this webinar, we've got a panel of leading compliance experts who are here to share some of the most common litigation pitfalls associated with the FCRA. Before I introduce our panel, let me take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and information. Also, for those who might be interested, I provide content marketing services such as blog posts, email newsletters, social media posts, and other custom content that is exclusive and unique to each client. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. LaDonna Bowling is the Chief Compliance Officer with Receivable Solutions. She has more than 20 years of operational and compliance experience in third-party debt collections, experience in all verticals serving creditors and debt buyers. She's a certified instructor for ACA International and was named one of the 25 most influential women in collections by Collection Advisor magazine. She was also named ACA International's Certified Instructor of the Year for 2019. Glenn Brown is a senior member of Squire Patton Boggs Data Privacy Group and provides business-oriented advice to clients in numerous industries on regulatory compliance matters, including investigations and examinations by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Federal Trade Commission. Having served in-house as an associate general counsel and chief compliance officer at a large consumer reporting agency, Glenn has firsthand experience understanding of the day-to-day issues faced by clients when creating and implementing corporate compliance systems. Katie Spicer is a senior litigation associate at Squire Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., where she is a member of the Czar's TCPA World Team. She specializes in complex litigation and government investigations to include consumer and privacy litigation and data breach investigations. She first honed her consumer law acumen as a Marine Corps attorney, where she was responsible for advising service members about their various rights under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Truth in Lending Act, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and the Service Members Civil Relief Act. After 14 years on active duty, Katie transitioned to private practice at Squire Patton Boggs, where she now defends companies in high-stake litigation and internal investigations. Greg Stevens has more than 30 years of experience with financial institutions, having worked as in-house and outside counsel, and as a litigator with the U.S. Department of Justice Tax Division. He's a partner in McGlinchey's Dallas office, handling commercial litigation and representing companies pertaining to federal statutes governing consumer financial services. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to ask questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it to us through the chat module. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area and should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. All right, with that, we can move on to our discussion now. Let's talk, there's a couple of different areas within the FCRA that I think are relevant and worth spending time on today. One of the first things that we've seen some recent cases on that apply is the issue of background checks and job applications. Glenn, maybe you can take us through that first as we start the discussion on that topic.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike. So the FCRA, as I think most folks know, regulates certain sensitive uses of people's personal information. So things like lending and insurance underwriting collections, obviously. Hard pressed to find an area that more people are focused on now than employment in these times. And so, because that's such an impactful use of your personal information, The FCRA regulates it. And again, given the outcomes of the background screening process, it's not a surprise that it gets litigated quite heavily. You know, if you have to pay $20 a month more in your insurance premium or something because of an error in the consumer report, it doesn't tend to drive litigation. If you don't get a job, especially when jobs are scarce, people tend to get litigious. And so that has been, as Mike noted, a hot area of litigation. So, you know, as an employer or as a furnisher to CRAs that provide consumer reports for employment, some of the areas that have been litigated most heavily are things like the FCRA's requirement to provide a standalone disclosure to consumers prior to ordering a background report. So the FCRA has a specific requirement that before ordering a background report when it's being used for employment, a clear and conspicuous disclosure in a document that consists of solely that disclosure has to be provided to a consumer. Fortunately for us, that requirement is not the basis for a private right of action. Only a state or federal agency can enforce that requirement. But plaintiffs' lawyers have gotten creative. And so what they do is they sue and they say, well, you didn't, let me walk that back for a second. You can sue, you can sue on that. And so because that's a mechanical procedural requirement, like a lot of requirements in the FCRA, and because the FCRA has statutory penalties for violations, it's not surprising that plaintiffs have sued claiming that employers haven't provided them that standalone document. So, you know, employers get tripped up in this by doing things like including the disclosure in an employment agreement. That's clearly an ancillary issue compared to the substance of the employment agreement, and that's not going to pass statutory muster. But you also can't include in your disclosure things like liability waivers, acknowledgement of at-will status. You can't even include disclosures, similar disclosures that are required by state law as opposed to the federal FCRA. So there was a case recently where a California law required very similar disclosures to what the FCRA requires. An employer with common sense just combined the two and gave the disclosure covering both federal and state law to their job applicants, and a court found that violated the FCRA. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's, you know, literally construed. And so that requirement is a kind of a ticky-tack, you might say, requirement, but it's something that gets litigated frequently, and so you ought to be aware of it. Another thing I would point out is the employment context for consumer reports is unique in that under every permissible purpose under the FCRA for getting a consumer report, if you make an adverse decision to the consumer's interests, you have to provide an adverse action letter that explains that it was based on a consumer report, where they can sort of challenge the accuracy of the consumer report, et cetera. In the employment context, it does require that, but it also requires an employer to provide what's called a pre-adverse action notice. That is, before they take an adverse action, an employer has to provide a consumer with the consumer report that was used and a statement of their rights. The theory behind that is if a consumer gets that and sees that there's an error in it that has, you know, presumably caused them not to be hired or to be fired or whatever, they would have time then before the adverse action was taken to then go dispute the accuracy of that report. That's why they require it to be provided prior to taking an adverse action. In reality, almost every employer of any decent size in America has what they call adjudication guidelines now, where they get the results of a consumer report background screen and apply them against sort of a rubric, you know, depending on the position, what's in the consumer report, and use that those guidelines to say, okay, this person is eligible or not eligible. And it's sort of done, I mean, literally sometimes in an automated fashion, sometimes it's just a kind of a rote exercise. And lots of plaintiffs have sued saying that violates the FCRA because when you scored me or when you applied my consumer report against this rubric. That was the adverse action. You didn't send me a letter before that, a notice before that, therefore you violated the FCRA. Cases have come out kind of on both sides of that. There are some things you can do if you're an employer and you use those kinds of guidelines. You need to make it real clear that those are preliminary guidelines, that no hiring decision has been made based on those preliminary guidelines until a manual review has been conducted. The application of those guidelines should cause you to send out that pre-adverse action letter so that, you know, the actual hiring decision comes after the notice has been given. But that's a real commonly litigated issue. And then, you know, another thing just to point out, Mike, is that just a lot of people have the understanding of the application of the FCRA in the employment context. I think everybody understands that clearly covers when I'm applying for a job, right? If I'm a new applicant, I come in, a background search is conducted. Everybody understands that's FCRA regulated. What they don't understand is the term employment purposes in the FCRA is actually defined, and it's quite broad, much broader than just at the point of hire. It includes sort of periodic rescreens that some companies do every 2 or 3 years on their employee base. It covers eligibility for assignments. So if I'm already been hired, I'm an employee, I'm going to be assigned to work for one specific customer of my employer, and that customer has certain requirements. They say, okay, well, to come on site, you've got to do a background check and include these things. That's FCRA governed because it's eligibility not only for employment, but for an assignment. Also, contractors, many courts have found that contractor screening is FCRA governed activity, because if I'm a contractor going to work for a home improvement store, for example, going to go install the tile that the customer bought at the home improvement store, and I'm going to go do the on-site work for that, and the home improvement store says, okay, I've got to be background screened before I can go to somebody's house, that's eligibility for an assignment. And so it's for an employment purpose and needs to be compliant with the FCRA. So, you know, and then of course you've just got accuracy claims that are the fodder for lots of kinds of FCRA litigation. And again, because of the sort of heightened impact on a consumer that results from, you know, potentially a mistake in the consumer report, the accuracy obligation under Section 604B of the FCRA comes into play quite often. I was the head of the legal department for the largest background screening company in the U.S. at that time for several years. And I can't tell you how many creative claims we saw, because when people lose their jobs and the reason is a background report, whether it's accurate or not accurate, that's a very, you know, most of the time it's a very sympathetic plaintiff for a judge or jury. And so, you know, these things can be tough, but everybody ought to know that, you know, the stakes are pretty high when you're involved in employment-related background screening.
Glenn, let me ask you a question. So what do you do when you're down to the wire hiring for a critical position, let's say an accountant, one for your IT security networking, and then they know fully up front, you know, what your requirements are for passing a background check. You run that background check, it doesn't pass. Maybe you have some client requirements you have to adhere to, some regulatory requirements. So, mm-hmm. Give that person adverse action and hold our position, just kind of keep it just hovering before we can bring somebody in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of real-world conflicts. And all I can say is that to avoid the, you know, the exposure under the FCRA, you know, you really do need to have compliance with the requirements, even if that does mean potentially having to hold it open. I mean, there are all kinds of conflicts, right? So another good example is under the Federal Deposit Insurance Act, banks are supposed to be screening employees to a certain level. So they want background screening companies to go back 10 years in looking for certain items, adverse items of information. Well, the FCRA doesn't allow you to do that. They've got, for most things, a 7-year cut off. So you can't report back as a consumer reporting agency and as an employer, you can't receive a consumer report that has, you know, certain kinds of adverse information that go beyond 7 years. But the federal statute requires you to. So what do? Right? We've worked that through with lots of legislators and regulators, and there's no answer. There's just a conflict. And so, you know, that the FCRA is, and I don't know if you've covered this in previous webinars, Mike, but the FCRA is a strikingly poorly drafted document with lots of circular definitions, undefined terms, and sloppy drafting. And so there are lots of these, like, just, you know, traps for the unwary that you have to deal with, that when reality, you know, kind of butts up against a statute that was drafted in 1970.
Which is why we're here today, trying to figure this all out. Thanks. Before we move off this topic, sort of the background check job application angle with respect to the FCRA, do any of the other panelists want to weigh in or share any remarks? Or if anyone in the audience has a question about this, now would be the perfect time to ask it before we move on to our next topic. Does anyone else have anything else you want to add?
Mike, I just wanted to add that consumer advocates are really into how these reports are used in the negativity toward consumers, because we all know that a credit report is a dangerous tool and can impact somebody's life from the job or even from tenant screening. Folks that are trying to get apartments or rent or lease houses and they're turned down because of inaccuracy on their credit report. And a lot of times they'll have to go back and reapply or maybe pay a new deposit to get their application resubmitted. So just word to the audience out here that's where the accuracy and integrity comes in from being a data furnisher.
And I'd also add one thing for anybody out there that is thinking that they should probably take a look at their screening practices. The FCRA is not the only thing that comes into play here. There are actually a lot of state laws that talk about what you can use in the employment context, particularly credit reports. Many states have laws that say you can only use credit reports in these circumstances, no other, and so forth. Other state laws prohibit a practice that had been pretty common, which is kind of check the box. Check the box if you've ever been convicted of a felony, whatever, for example. Those kind of things have been increasingly prohibited under state law because states view them as, a tool that employers will use just to throw a resume out the window, you know, if they see that box check. So my point being, just know that there are state laws that come into play in this as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Glenn. Let's move on. I think we can sort of categorize the next series of discussion topics. We'll file it under disputes. There's a lot of different things with respect to disputes that furnishers and companies have to be aware of that could potentially end them up in court. So let's start to talk a little bit about some cases where a furnisher or defendant has been sued for failing to mark a trade line as disputed. This would seem, at least to me, the non-lawyer, that this would be a fairly straightforward thing, but obviously it's not. So Greg, maybe you could walk us through some of the pitfalls as it relates to this topic.
Yeah, I'll start on this. Basically, whether to mark it as disputed is covered under 1681 S2A, and there's no private right of action under S2A, but we've still seen a lot of litigation on when you have to mark it as disputed. And you also have to look to determine whether or not the dispute is meritorious. What I usually advise clients to do, to the extent they can, you know, just from a practical point of view, and the bureaus may to some extent disagree, if you get a letter from a consumer that's disputing the account, I have trouble seeing a true downside in putting the XB code on the trade line. I think it's a preventive measure to prevent disputes. Now, I know they're supposed to term off after you're done with your investigation. So if you do your investigation and you determine that it's not a dispute or not a bona fide dispute, you could take it off. But does anybody else see on the panel see an issue with just with marking it as, you know, putting the notation on the trade line to marking it as the account's disputed?
That's what we do. Keep it in dispute status.
Yeah, I know. I don't think there's a legal issue with that for sure, because it goes kind of beyond what the law requires. I know that, you know, some CRAs wouldn't want to do that because for fear of, you know, over time, those tags becoming so numerous that their customers might start questioning the accuracy of their data. But there's certainly no legal issue with that. And you just have to sort of weigh the risks.
But we have been successful. And Katie may want to chime in too from her experiences. When we get, you know, a piece of litigation in where the consumer files a lawsuit alleging I disputed the account and I didn't mark it, and the client didn't mark it as disputed, I found we've been successful if on a motion to dismiss or 12B6, so the court will give them an opportunity, usually a pro se plaintiff, an opportunity to replead that there's just not enough facts that would satisfy the Twombly pleading standard. You know, okay, you're disputing it. Well, what are you disputing? I mean, I have a case where I called the consumer up who was pro se and asked him, what are you disputing? I'm representing the bank. And he's like, well, you should know. Well, your letter just says I dispute it. That doesn't do you any good or my client any good. But we've been successful in getting the courts to dismiss cases along those lines, although they usually give them an opportunity to replead. And usually without fail, they still can't plead what they are disputing. I mean, you see a lot of people try to pull some information off the internet, how to dispute your report. And that's where this is, where a lot of this is coming from.
So what do you think about the ploy of some of the predatory attorneys who send you a fax saying that the consumer disputes it, and when in fact, you know, a fax never came in? I know I tangled with a predatory attorney a couple of years ago where we checked our records, checked our fax log, no dispute ever came in. So of course we never marked the account as being disputed. And next thing I know, we're getting a demand for money because we violated the FDCPA and the FCRA. So I disconnected our fax machine.
Yeah, I've seen that. I mean, look to check to see the number it came in on. I usually will go back to them and say, do you have a document or the you know, the verification page? There's so few people who use fax machines anymore. I guess I'm showing my age. I remember when we first got that when I was a young lawyer. We thought that was the neatest thing since sliced bread, and now, you know, no one uses fax machines anymore. But what we try to do is see if they have a verification page. And if they do have a verification page and it did come in, we try to track it down to some extent. And sometimes they miss it. The other thing they will tend to do is send it to this offbeat fax number that may be offshore somewhere or not, you know, a main fax number. And the problem you have with those cases and what the courts could potentially say, and I've seen them say it, you're still responsible for your faxes. That if they come into your company, you're still responsible to handle them.
I would also add that Greg's absolutely right that, you know, in the event of a dispute that's not really a bona fide dispute, you know, there's definitely some opportunity there to get rid of the matter. For those that are bona fide disputes where the furnisher has just failed to reflect the status for whatever reason, you know, I think the point here is that courts are pretty sympathetic. You know, there's been cases that say, look, a disputed debt is materially different than an undisputed debt, even where the plaintiff wouldn't have prevailed, you know, on a trial of the actual facts of the dispute. Just the fact that it's been disputed is materially different to the user of the consumer report, and therefore a failure to show that. That dispute flag or code is makes it sort of materially inaccurate for purposes of 1681 S2B. And so it's just, the takeaway is just, you know, really sort of drill down on your process for flagging disputed matters if you're a furnisher, make sure that you're doing it. And I think like Greg said, there's you know, a lot to be said for an over-inclusive strategy of just, you know, not worrying so much about how long it's going to be on there, but making sure that it gets on there. And if it stays on there, you know, that maybe may not, it's not a legal issue for sure.
Okay, well, you used to work for CRA, right?
I did, yeah.
Okay, now a consumer advocate told me that 40% of disputes come from debt collectors, even though they only make 13% of the trade line information. Is that your experience?
You know, I'm not, I can't recall the metrics off the top of my head. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if that were accurate at a given CRA, just because, again, you look at, you know, these things tend to be driven by the sensitivity, right? So, you know, debt collection is a highly sensitive process for consumers. They tend to get pretty, you know, riled up about it. So that wouldn't surprise me.
We talked a little bit about fax machines. What about email addresses? Can the dispute come into an email? How do you sort of make sure that, you know, you're monitoring all those email addresses? Is that something that needs to be concerned? And we haven't heard from Katie yet, so I'm going to put her on the spot and ask her that question.
Yeah, well, I think it just deals with what your compliance protocols are within your company. And if that's what it is, and what your dispute process is, then as long as you're following that and doing the reasonable investigation, you should be covered.
Like I say, an omni-channel communication is the buzz now, right? Opening up all the communication channels for consumers. And with that comes the responsibility of managing all these communication channels. You know, whether you've got, you know, 5 distribution emails set up for consumers to communicate with you, you have to man those and look for the risk with the disputes.
So how do you do that? How are you doing that?
As carefully as possible.
Good answer.
Policies, and don't create more communication channels than you can manage. You know, it sounds all good, but you know, you got to be able to manage it.
I would just add that in my experience, the folks that get that you want for these kind of roles of, like, you know, monitoring email traffic, faxes, whatever, and responding to it, taking it in, the sort of consumer facing operations, that's an exceptionally difficult job of hiring the right folks, because it requires much more, in my experience, much more sort of mental horsepower than your typical sort of call center folks. But yet it's kind of a highly repetitive job. And so getting the right person in that role to take responsibility, ownership over those kinds of processes can be really difficult, even for a big, you know, CRA or furniture. But it's doable. I mean, you just have to have really tight operational metrics and processes to make sure that the right things are focused on and that things don't get, you know, don't fall through the cracks.
Moving on, let's spend some time talking about reasonable investigation and some of the areas that furnishers need to be mindful of there, lest they end up, you know, unless they become a defendant instead, or in addition to being a furnisher. What are some of the things that people should be on the lookout for with respect to conducting a reasonable investigation? LaDonna, let's start with you this time.
Well, it comes down to you defining what a reasonable investigation is, because according to the FCRA, it's not defined. It says that we must do a reasonable investigation. So you define what your reasonable investigation consists of. And I think it's easier to do a reasonable investigation when you get a written dispute from a consumer, or you have the consumer on the telephone and you can ask some probing questions. That can help you better. But when you get the disputes through the CRA, and a lot of agencies are accused of just comparing what's in the dispute from the CRA to what's in their database and saying it's legit, when if you have a wrong balance and the consumer's disputing the balance and you're just saying it matches, that's not a reasonable investigation. So it's one of those situations I'm sure one of these smart lawyers here could speak to. Hint, hint, lawyer.
Very smart lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at what gets litigated, where furnishers get hung up is just like what LaDonna is talking about. They just do this cursory review. They just they receive it in. They just look at what the file is in front of them, and what is actually required is a searching inquiry. You know, do they have mechanisms in place to say, or are they trained well enough to say, okay, maybe this requires me to go back and look at prior, the original application for the credit card or prior lending documents. Do they have the ability to do that? But if they're just going to kind of do, I've got pressure on me to do 3 minutes per investigation or per dispute and move on to the next one, all I'm doing is verifying the social security number and the name. Well, that's just going to be a cursory review.
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, you know, in the context of debt collection, debt buyers, you know, there are a few good cases out there that talk about, you know, a furnisher that is a, in this cases I've looked at, the debt buyers, those cases, you know, it talks about what's a reasonable reinvestigation. You know, again, just looking at your own internal system and saying, okay, well, it matches what the CRA said is really not enough. I mean, you know, in one case I'm aware of, you know, the debt buyer didn't look at any account level documentation from the debt sellers or from the original creditors. And that's, you know, clearly an expectation is to go beyond just what you have in front of you. What you do need to look at what the CRA said, but looking at that, you know, alone isn't sufficient. You know, it's going to depend on the circumstances, including like what's the status of the furnisher? Are they the original creditor? Are they a down the line debt buyer? Maybe the debt's been sold several times and you're at the end. Did you buy it from the original creditor? I mean, it depends on those kinds of questions. And what kind of documentation you have to even refer to. Clearly you're in a better position or you're in a worse position if you had a lot of documentation around that debt you didn't look at, right? Then if you had none and you basically did everything you could reasonably could have been expected to do. So it's very fact intensive, but clearly, I think the point is clearly there's an expectation that you really take into account any kind of information you might have, no matter whether it came from the CRA or the consumer self, or whether you just have knowledge of the existence of documentation, anything that can inform your analysis of what the consumer's claiming.
But it's hard to manage. It's hard to get the manpower, you know, and meet your bottom line requirements when doing these reasonable investigations, when the disputes from the CRAs are hitting you hard and heavy, and then you get the robo disputes, and then you get the written disputes from the consumer because they've downloaded a form off the internet and they're asking for all of these things that you legally don't have to supply to them. So it's hard to manage and to make sure that you're not really stepping on any consumer rights as well.
I would break it up to two types of disputes, the ones that are direct to the consumers and the ones that are indirect that come from the credit reporting agencies. With regards to the credit reporting agencies ones, that's where there is potential 1681 S2B liability, although if you do get a dispute in, you have to look at everything that you may have received beforehand. But some of the cases now are going in favor of the consumer where they look at how much time a creditor spent or furnished spent in reviewing a dispute. For example, I believe it was the Siemens case versus Temple University out of the Third Circuit that said, you know, I think you only spent a few minutes per dispute, and, you know, that in and of itself may be unreasonable. So I think it's very important to have solid procedures in place and train your people on what they should do when they get a dispute. The other thing I highly recommend too is for a litigation context, is to, and you may be hearing, of course, figures there's yard work going on outside the house right now, the perils of working from home. But when you do get a dispute in and you're investigating it, it's probably well worth your time, and it may take a little more time to do, but make a note of the steps you took to investigate the dispute. That way, if a lawsuit comes, there's a 2-year statute of limitations under the FCRA. You can then go back and look at the contemporaneous notes you may have taken of what you did with regards, you know, to the dispute. Because if I'm in the plaintiff's bar, I'm not going to want, you know, your corporate representative. I'm going to want the person to take the deposition who signed the e-Oscar or the ACDV form in responding to the dispute. And the last thing you're going to want them to stay is, you know, when they ask you about your reasonable investigation, you don't want them to say, what investigation? You know, that doesn't end well. So I think training is incredibly important in this context.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And not just onboarding training, but regular periodic training. And the more process you can have around this function, as LaDonna said, it takes resources, and those are tough to come by when you're competing with other parts of the organization. But you know, it's a question of, do we spend money on resources and people and processes to document this stuff and avoid liability, or do we not, and we face these suits that you have a hard time defending because you haven't got a lot of process in place.
Well, the whole purpose of this webinar was, you know, the FCRA lawsuits are on the increase, and that's been happening for the last 3 or 4 years, I believe. You know, FDCPA is going down. It's because we're getting better with FDCPA, and we feel like we can own it. Now, you know, FCRA is a hot commodity, and I think that the resounding thing here, the thread is training, training, and training.
Yeah, and I'd also add consistency. So you're in a much better position if you've got a policies and procedures that are hewn to pretty closely, that are followed, and they're followed because you've trained on it repeatedly, right? As long as your policies and procedures are reasonable, you're going to get, you know, some benefit of the doubt from a court when those procedures are challenged. If you are operating in a context where it appears, it may not be true, but it appears like you're kind of winging it because you don't have a lot of training, you don't, you know, do audits to see if your policies are actually being followed. You may have a policy, but there's no follow-up to see if you're following it. Those kind of situations are where you're very unlikely to get the benefit of the doubt. So, you know, having reasonable policies that are trained on, that are assessed, that are audited, will help you get the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, Greg as a litigator may have more perspective on that than I do. And Katie as well. Sorry.
Go ahead, sorry.
No.
You sure?
I was just trying to do your job.
Go ahead.
And back to you, Greg.
Yeah, no, I think you have to have, the policies in place and try to follow them to the best that you can. The courts are going to, you know, it's still, at the end of the day, it's still a consumer protection statute. So there's going to be to some extent, a bias in favor of the consumers. And everybody understands nowadays that credit means everything. I mean, for example, if you didn't, you know, pay a bill and there may be an FDCPA violation, your statutory damages are $1,000, cry me a river. But if somebody's like a victim of identity theft, has done what they can, and you don't have good policies in place, litigation could be quite daunting and quite scary because everyone knows you need credit, which makes the world go around. There looks like there was a question that came in that said, what reasonable steps are sufficient? And, you know, I'd throw this open for a minute, but I think as LaDonna, I think, referred to, I think you have to go beyond what's in the ACDV to some extent. Look at the file. See if there's been any direct disputes. What's the consumer saying? If it's an identity theft, you may have to potentially call the consumer who's making the complaint. You can't fit a reasonable investigation into a square box. And that's what I think too many people try to do. You have to look at it, you know, each dispute to the extent individually. And I understand there has to be some, scale in what you can do and what you can't do given the volume. But I think you have to take a look at, you know, what the dispute is and then go from there. Some disputes may take not a long time. Some disputes may take a little longer.
And Reg V clarifies that we should have policies and procedures that fit our organization, our business, you know, because like what would work for me might not work for another agency. So they have to be catered pretty much tailored to your agency and how you do business. I see head nodding, so y'all agree with me, right?
Yes.
Well, and especially now, compliance can't be any more important given the state of things. I mean, disputes are already heavily litigated, and absolutely in the coming months and years, they're going to be even more aggressively litigated as the plaintiff bar tries to wrap their arms around the CARES Act and the accommodations provision and what that means for reporting accurately on consumer reports. So taking a step back, looking at your dispute procedures now, understanding that there will be implications from the CARES Act, which I think Greg is going to get into in a little bit, but also everybody should be really mindful that right now the three major agencies are allowing consumers to pull their credit weekly for free. Historically, it's been one time a year. Every 12 months, you can get a free credit report. Now they're able to pull and verify their credit reports weekly, which I would think is going to have a direct impact on the number of disputes that are coming in.
Madonna, Greg brought up direct versus indirect disputes. I know that was something you wanted to talk about. Were there anything else that you wanted to add on that before we moved on to something else?
No, other than the fact that it's labor intensive and keeping up and trying to meet the standards of promptness for responding to disputes, because we have 30 days to respond. When it comes from a CRA, we are not given an extension, and that's from the CRA gets it, 30 days from the CRA gets it. So it is labor intensive, and there are some softwares out there that can make it a little bit easier for you, but it still doesn't stop all the nefarious people who dispute.
I'm curious, because we've heard panelists talk about the need for sort of consistency and policies and procedures with respect to how to conduct an investigation. And then we've also heard that you kind of have to sort of look at it on a case by case basis. So how do you manage sort of doing both of those things at the same time? How do you have sort of a set of policies and procedures? We're going to do X, Y, and Z on every, you know, when a dispute comes in, but also have the flexibility to say, okay, this is, look at the dispute and then sort of figure out what the best course of action is in terms of how to investigate it.
I think you can have procedures documents that that address, you know, the scenarios you see most often, and for each one of the scenarios, kind of what the steps are, and also just having a clear escalation process for those kind of tricky cases, one-off cases that come your way, just to have an official, you know, escalation path also helps, and have some sort of separate training potentially for the people that get those escalated disputes. That's clearly a tension there.
And sometimes you have to reevaluate your processes and make changes.
Good advice. Before we move on, there's a couple of questions that have come in. If a provider cannot provide verification within 30 days, can we delete the item and then re-report it if and when the provider looks locates verification? Thumbs up, thumbs down, or am I going to hear people say it depends?
Well, a CRA, the limitation is that a CRA, if it deletes information because of that 30-day issue, it can't then reintroduce the information unless you go through a sort of statutorily prescribed process, which involves notifying the consumer. So if you know you deleted something because you couldn't get 30 days and you got your answer back on the 35th day, before you can put it back in the file, they've got to go notify the consumer. And so a lot, you know, it's just a question of, do you want to go through that hassle when that would, you know, that would clearly, in most cases, annoy the consumer. Not that we're looking to avoid annoying consumers at all costs, but, you know, you don't want to annoy them to the point of litigating an issue. So just know that you can't, you get an answer after that date, you can't just then just stick it back in because a certain procedure has to be followed.
But it might be a deeper problem if your clients, you know, the creditors can't get the information to you that you need in a timely manner. You might need to look at that and perhaps go to that client and say, you're asking that I credit report, but you're creating great risk for us because, you know, 5 out of 7 requests, you know, are untimely answered or you don't have the information. So those are all things that we're expected to look at. You know, the CRAs are expected to police the data furnishers, and the data furnishers, we're expected to police our clients and the information that we're supplying to the CRAs. It just kind of goes around in a circle.
That's exactly right. I mean, a CRA, if it had enough of those kinds of issues with a furnisher, could very well conclude that, and in some cases should conclude, that that's not a reliable source of information. And so, you know, cease taking data from that furnisher.
Speaking of clients, another question that came in, can a debt collector's client be held liable for the debt collector's negligence under the FCRA?
I say it goes back to your contract. As a data furnisher, I'm putting language in that contract that's going to protect me, but one of these smart attorneys might need to answer that. Do, 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 do.
Crickets. I guess we'll leave one open. Oh, wait, Greg's going to step up.
I'd have to look at it, but I think there could potentially be vicarious, you know, liability in there. There's two separate things, whether they would be liable to the consumer, and which is separate and apart from whether they're liable to their client, which would be based on the contract.
Okay.
At least he didn't say it depends.
Another question. What is the best practice when a consumer states identity theft, but after the investigation, it is discovered to be a false claim? Does anyone have an answer for that one?
Well, it depends. It depends. No, I mean, if you have a documentation that refutes what was disputed and that identity theft actually did not happen, well, then, you know, keep that documentation and report that trade line how you need to report it.
Good answer. Yeah, absolutely.
Another question. Is it okay that I aggregate CRA disputes with direct disputes to deem them frivolous and irrelevant?
What was that question?
Is it okay that I aggregate CRA disputes with direct disputes to deem them frivolous and irrelevant?
You can't deem frivolous or irrelevant if it comes from a CRA. Right,
maybe,
smart people?
Maybe he meant CRO, credit repair organization. That would be a different ballgame.
Yeah, it would be.
So if you ask that question, if you want to clarify, by all means, send another question. I'm happy to ask it to the panel. Greg, we've talked a little bit. It's been mentioned about the CARES Act and the implication that that's going to have on the FCRA. Maybe you can spend a few minutes walking us through that.
Yeah, I will. Basically, the CARES Act added a whole new section to the FCRA. It added subsection F to 1681 S2A, which governs reporting during the pandemic. And basically, it governs, you know, how you report if an accommodation is granted. And it has a lot of broad language in there. It includes what includes accommodation, you know, how is a consumer affected by COVID-19, what is the covered period. And I think I'll start real quickly with the, you know, what they define an accommodation. An accommodation, cut to the core without getting into too much legalese, is any deviation from the payment arrangement in favor of consumers. So if there's a contract with the consumer and they're supposed to pay $50 a month and you're going to either forbear it or allow them to pay $20 a month, you've given them an accommodation. Another issue there is, does the accommodation have to be granted because the consumer was affected by COVID-19? And if you parse the language carefully, I don't think that's the case. I think it's any accommodation during this period, which it would be a covered period, which began on January 31st, which was prior to the enactment of the CARES Act, and it's going to end 120 days after the date on which the national emergency declared by the president is terminated. And as of this point, it has not been, which has not been terminated yet. So for example, we're heading into, you know, June 1st. So let's say on June 1st, the national emergency is terminated. The cover period will go through, you know, November 1st of 2020. Also regarding another issue with who was affected by COVID, you know, 19, it's, you don't want as a furnisher to get into a battle with the consumer regarding, well, you really haven't been affected by COVID-19, because I think everyone has been affected by COVID-19. I mean, I think we're a perfect example of it. I'm sitting here in my living room, Glenn's in his living room, looks like Donna's in her house, and Katie is in her house. So I think everybody has been affected by COVID-19. But I think the biggest takeaway in the limited time we have regarding the CARES Act is how you report. So if you give an accommodation, you can't, you have to, let me back up. If the account is current at the time the accommodation was granted, you're supposed to continue, not you're supposed to, you must continue to report the account as current. So if you're going to say, if you're going to allow the consumer not to pay for 90 days and they were current at the time the accommodation was granted, you must continue to report the account as current. Now, this doesn't, this changes slightly if the account was, let's say it was 60 days past due and you gave them an, you gave the consumer an accommodation. At that point, if it's a 6-month accommodation, you still report the account and you may continue to report the account as 60 days past due. You cannot report the account as 90 days past due or 120 days past due as time goes on. You must maintain the reporting. Now, however, if the consumer brings the account current during the accommodation period, then you must change the reporting to keep it as current. So I would think of it this way. The credit reporting for the consumer under the CARES Act cannot get any worse. It can only get better. Now, that there's one other exception to it, and that's if it's a charged-off account, you may continue to report the charge-off. But I think if you think of it in the terms of you got to freeze the reporting at the time the accommodation was given, that would be a safe way to handle the actual reporting of the trade line.
Do you see an increase in lawsuits coming after this is over? I know you got a crystal ball. Look at your crystal ball.
I see a tidal wave of lawsuits potentially coming over this. This issue. There's going to be an issue on whether or not you gave the accommodation or you reported the account, you know, as 90 days past due when it should have been 60 days past due, and you didn't, you know, update the trade line appropriately. Now, let me preface it by saying one thing. This is under 1681 S2A, and there's still no private right of action under 1681 S2A of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. However, you can bet you're going to see ACDVs come in that say, that will dispute the trade line and saying that you didn't report it correctly because of the CARES Act, and that will open up a potential, you know, flood of litigation.
Is that the answer you were looking for, LaDonna?
Not a typical lawyer answer, though. No, I was glad he started out with for sure, you know.
Oh, I think it's going to be, I think there's going to be a lot of, it's going to be a lot of litigation under it. And again, it's a consumer protection statute. And when in doubt on something like this, I think in your reporting, you have to, you want to report accurately, but you have to keep that in the back of your mind. And think, when you think about how quickly the CARES Act was enacted. So it's part of it sloppily drafted, which also will provide a you know, a fertile source of litigation.
Thank you very much. To the last question about aggregating disputes, we did have someone write in, don't call your CRO disputes frivolous and irrelevant, excuse me, because with that status comes responsibilities. Merely invoke the CRO exemption in Reg V and ignore them. Be sure you have a policy that defines a CRO dispute, shows how you recognize them, and provides a process how to handle them. Well said. Another question that came in with respect to the CARES Act, is there any federal guidance regarding the credit reporting changes to the CARES Act?
That would be the CARES Act and all of its glory.
Now, there has been...
that's what makes it so difficult right now is because it is so ambiguous. But just like Greg said, it's, you know, the whole intent is not putting our borrowers in a worse position than they were prior to the whole pandemic kicking off.
All right. Well, we've just about run out of time, but before we wrap up, I'd like to go around the panel and give each of the panelists a chance to share any parting words of wisdom, any key takeaways, any concluding remarks. Greg can talk about the logging work that's being done outside if he wants to. But just to sort of keep in mind, you know, any sort of anything else that they wanted to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about during our conversation so far. And Greg, we'll start with you.
One thing I will add is that the CFPB on April 1st came down with a statement that said that they would show some flexibility in enforcing the law that you have 30 days to respond to a dispute. You know, for a consumer, unfortunately, it became very political. And so 23 attorney generals basically stated, no, we're going to expect you to comply with the statute to the letter. So that's hanging out there. So even if the CFPB said that they're not going to take immediate action, the law is still that you have 30 days to respond to a dispute, and by all means try to comply with that deadline. And I understand everybody's workforce is stretched at this time.
Excellent. Thank you. Glenn?
Yeah, I would just say, we didn't really talk about this, but just to encourage people to sort of take a fresh look at your processes, whether it's around, you know, flagging things as disputed or whatever, but your processes that are governed by the FCRA. My experience, where companies, whether they're CRAs or furnitures, or whatever, get hung up a lot and where they get in trouble is because they have processes that were, you know, maybe they were implemented as a one-off solution to address a complaint that was filed or something like that, and they just self-perpetuate and nobody ever really questions them. And especially as litigation gets ramped up and as the environment evolves, I think it's a great exercise just to question your own policies and processes and procedures to understand why you're doing something. And does it have a solid basis? And does it really give you the compliance boost that you anticipate? That would be my two cents.
Thank you very much. LaDonna?
I was going to piggyback off what he said. I think that it's important that we have policies, procedures. We are evaluating what we do, looking at patterns and trends, changing the process if need be, because this is a treacherous area already. And after CARES Act, after COVID-19, it's going to get even more treacherous. So look at your policies, look at your procedures, train, and train.
Choo-choo. Katie?
Yeah, and I would just say, make sure, you know, every day join the alerts for the CFPB and the FTC, so you can keep abreast of what's going on there, because they're really pushing out consumer-related information, stuff that impacts FCRA. And if you know it's a priority to them, it's probably a priority to the plaintiff's bar as well. So.
That's a very good tip. Greg, Glenn, LaDonna, Katie, thank you so much for joining me today on this webinar. I really appreciate your insights and your expertise. Great job.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching. We'll be back soon with more webinars. We've got one tomorrow on what's going on at the state level. We've got one on Thursday where we're looking at the HEROES Act. So I hope you come back for those. And stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net. for more news and webinars in the near future. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your day. Stay safe.